All right. Welcome to the Ideas and Identity Podcast. I'm J. Michael Hudson. I'm here with Jen and...
Jen Appel.
Jen Appel. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were already into a conversation here, so we thought we'd start recording. And
yeah, we were just discussing the exciting happenstance on New Year's that J. Michael had at his workplace, or his former place of work, and he was telling me this really fascinating story.
Well, I got fired on New Year's Eve. Well, that's the first time I ever got fired on a holiday.
Oh, well, that kind of makes it extra special. It was beautiful little punctuation mark.
Yeah, right. Happy 2015. Yeah. You know, all right. Have a great year. See you never again. Yeah. And I was surprised by it. Something felt off or weird. Whenever I've been fired before, something always feels off and weird. Mm-hmm. My gut's like, why are these people acting strangely to me?
Right.
And it hadn't been that way for 2 or 3 weeks. And there was nothing to do. You know, I was doing a phone support job for grocery stores, point of sale, cash registers.
Okay.
And if nothing went wrong, then there's nothing to do.
Right.
So when they hired me, they were thinking that there could be like a major payment with issue with credit cards or something. We'd have to go out and answer a bunch of phone calls. But when none of that happened for the whole month, I think that they were just like not under any special pressure to keep me around if they didn't like me especially much. And I also think that I printed something on the office copier that I should not have.
You made a photocopy of your ass.
A little bit worse than that. You know? So, I don't know. You that sent me at a desk for 8 to 5 in an office. And I'm in the cubicle where everyone sees me because I'm the new guy. So they're just walking by all the time, looking at my screen. What am I doing? And so I had like 100 hours like that. You know, like sit in this chair and there's the internet, but don't do anything bad.
Right.
And we can read your mind if we want to. If we really want, we have the password to your computer.
And there's only so many ways you can rearrange your paper clips.
Yeah. I mean, so I was writing humorous essays. I read an entire programming book that was like 400 pages and did all the exercises. You know, I'm not a person that can sit there and do nothing. You know, or they'll gladly waste my time on stupid Farmville or Solitaire. So, but then eventually I would start to be like, okay, well, I'm sitting there today. What am I going to think of? And so I started bringing my projects in mm-hmm. that weren't just like, you know, things I could research or study. And that happens to be my burlesque music on this given day. There's just one song, and it was particularly inspired by the office culture that was there. That I was like, you know, this is exactly what they say. And the title of that song is Keep It In Your Pants.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. The worst, the dirtiest song I possibly could have... It's maybe the third or fourth dirtiest song I could have ever written. You know, I printed on the copier thinking mm-hmm. I'll go home and practice this tonight.
Right.
I could have used my printer at home and maybe I'd still be in the job. But I thought, free ink, it's 10 feet away, I'll just do it. But that was the one time my print didn't go through. And the human resources person had to come out and unjam it. And guess what? She pulled out when it started working again, my song. Now, it didn't look to me like she comprehended what she read on that paper. But maybe she was like, what was this? And why was he a little bit nervous? And she could go back into the memory of the printer and then game all over. Or, alternately, I had maybe pressed print again, thinking that, oh, maybe it'll just go through this time. And that second print, after the first print went through, like an hour later printed. And then there's the song sitting there. Who possibly could have written this, you know? All fingers point at me.
Well, I think that there's something divine about being fired from a job. Mm. I really do. I was fired from a very sort of high-power corporate rock and roll job back in 2014. And it was like the best thing that ever happened to me. I would have continued in this hamster wheel of dissatisfaction, just constantly chasing the paycheck because... Honestly, I'm not any better off making half the amount of money I was making way back when because I'm not trying to pad my life with $4 or $5 coffees a day or, you know, buying things for my children because I can't be there. Mm-hmm. There is a value to being here now that you don't get when you are so deeply embroiled in somebody else's goal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed like a good idea, corporate rock and roll, just because it was still in rock and roll. And, like, I was tied into a theater and then I evolved into a regional position, which was more money and gave me a better sort of you know, perspective on things, and it was supposed to be easier, but I was gone for months at a time traveling on the road, and I've got little people, so.
What do you think
the blessing? Oh, they're my kids.
Oh, I'm talking about them. Oh. Why do you think they let you go?
Oh, I know why they let me go. Oh. I know why they let me go. We had a show in North Carolina that got rained out, and one of the bands decided that they were gonna like pull, and then it just like all of them started falling like dominoes. Mm-hmm. And we actually were emergency evacuated from our trailer because they were afraid that there was going to be a riot and they were going to push us down because the way our trailer was situated at the front of the festival was on a hill. So we were emergency evacuated from this trailer. It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. We had no idea what the fuck was going on.
It's like an episode of The Walking Dead. Oh, it
is. But they're like, fucked up, rock band.
Where's our band? We paid for this show.
Where's the beer?
We want our money back.
Yeah. Totally. Oh, yeah. So we came up with this major plan, and like we basically had to reinvent the wheel with the system that we were using in order to fulfill the plan. And I worked with an intern that I did not supervise to the greatest. And I trusted her, and I shouldn't have. So that's... Beware out there of the intern. Make sure you are really driving them, no matter how like sweet and like well-meaning they may seem. Anyway, she misplaced like 2,000 lines of data.
Oh.
And I did not notice it at first because we had a lot of duplication. So I figured we'd gone through and gotten all the duplication. Anyway, they were okay with that. And then it turned into a big thing. I feel like they just... knew they needed me through the season, and like basically after we were done with this, without naming the events, but like this barrage of back-to-back rock festivals, like the next day they came in and they were like, well, we think you know why. And I'm like, this is the greatest gift you've ever given me. Thank you for the severance package. Mm-hmm. I am looking forward to starting my yoga tomorrow. And I've been, like, in a total, like, zen balance place ever since. Like, there was a whole transformation that started even before that. And I feel like if I was still that person, I would still be in that job. But I needed to get rid of that. Like, here's a little backstory on me. At one point, weighed almost 300 pounds. And I feel like unpeeling each of these layers of bullshit has, like, I can't stuff it away anymore. I can't just sort of eat my feelings, eat away, like, office abuse, you know, my soon-to-be ex-husband. It's like all of this stuff. It's like, it's just unpeeling the layers so I can really feel, because that's part of it. And it actually, even in... like with the music, it started because one night I was pissed off at the way that my soon-to-be ex-husband was talking to me, and kids were in bed, and I'm like, fuck you, I'm going out. And I got in the car and looked up just to see where open mics were. I hadn't played out for 10 years, the last time I played. I've got 9-year-old twins. The last time I had played was when I was pregnant, and I lost use of my hands because I got... such severe carpal tunnel from swelling up with children. And noticed that the Uptown Arts Bar was having an open mic that night. I called my friend Katie. I'm like, I'm going. I just want to see what's going on there. I didn't even bring a guitar. Somebody else that I know showed up without a guitar, signed up, and said, I'm like, you could play without having an instrument? And she's like, yeah, dude, somebody will loan you something. So I went up to Keith, and I'm like, is this true? And he's like, yeah. And it was, like, the most amazing, like, moment in my life, because I wasn't going to do it. My friend Katie's like, do it, Jen. You know you want to do it. I was like, I don't know. She's like, do it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I played, I think, 3 songs that night. I had some 7-foot-tall, 300-pound black man come up to me first thing afterwards and tell me that I was like a mythical creature that called him inside. This woman from the IFC, like, basically, like, say, oh my God, you need to come to our meetings, and they're going to want to do documentaries on you, and they're going to want to know all about you. And Keith picked me up, and I thought that was really special, but apparently he picks up everybody. And when I say pick up, I mean lifted me up and spun me around. That is literally what I mean. He lifted my body up and spun me around, which I thought was sort of remarkable. But it's all, like, since mid-October that I've been back playing out, kind of inspired by, I have insomnia, and I was up in the middle of the night playing some of my old songs, and I had shown them to a friend of mine, and he's like, why aren't you doing this? So that was percolating for a little while, and then October came around, and I've been pretty steady since. Was asked to feature at the Uptown Arts Bar that first night that I played out, which is also kind of ridiculous considering that I hadn't played out in forever. And now I'm hosting a monthly night at Davies Uptown, too, of women's musicians.
Hey.
We had our first one last Thursday, and it's second Thursday of the month, and it's called the Uptown Sirens Collective. And we had Casey Guest and Taylor Mitchell and Ivory Black last week and myself. We've got a whole new lineup for the next month, which I don't know all the details on yet, but every second Thursday, so it's kind of amazing.
What's, like, the theater of the fantastic in Steppenwolf? Like, when you step down the road towards art, it's like you just don't know what's going to happen. Like you took a chance and went out when you were really questioning your voice,
mm-hmm.
and then, like, all the stuff that seems random, but it's magical.
Right, you know? Like validation.
Not magic, like, make the Statue of Liberty disappear.
Right.
But it's chaotic. Like, who do you meet? You meet all these people, but all these other, in life you have to make moves that give you more moves.
Yeah.
If you would have just stayed home, no new moves. But right. That one move, going to the Uptown Arts Bar, opened up 100 other moves.
Yeah.
Like in chess. Or
yeah,
like that,
for sure. It? No, it's kind of amazing and beautiful. And it's part of being present and, like, listening to whatever that inner voice says, like, I don't know. It's so easy to live life fearfully. And I don't want to do that anymore. I think I did that for too long. I've done things this year, like taken, like, risks in ways that I've never done before.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
La la.
No, like, seriously. Like, I've like always sort of, like, held back what I'm thinking or what I'm feeling, but, like, I have let it all out, and part of it has been, it doesn't always get the response that you want, but do I feel good about being brave about saying what I felt at that given moment? Fuck yes. Of course I do. I mean, it's empowering. Like, it's not like that I've got verbal diarrhea or that I'm saying things that are hurtful. It's more that I am speaking from my heart, and the brain filter sometimes does a disservice.
Yeah, right. Well, if it's I've experienced both, where I feel like I've overspoken and hurt someone's feelings, and I've left the room feeling like I didn't speak my piece. You know, there's going to be some of that in life for everybody. Like in this moment, for instance, mm-hmm. I'm thinking maybe I should, like, when. Maybe you're not aware, or you're probably not noticing this, but so when you talk,
mm-hmm.
you do this thing where you raise your hands up and you put your hands down like this again, kind of a lot. And usually it doesn't matter. And mm-hmm. this isn't like, oh, my feelings or somebody feels, but it's going to be picked up here on the microphone. So it'll be like every time you say it, it'll be like this, and then this, and this, and this.
This is funny, though, because when I went out for the very first time with my ex, soon to be ex-husband, I maybe should, like, make STBEH.
Right. We get the idea. Yes.
I need to come up with it. Anyway.
You can say your ex comfortably, even though the paperwork hasn't been filed.
The paperwork, or it's
not
fully through.
On this podcast, that's okay.
It's fine.
We're not going to send it down to beep or something like that.
But we had gone out, and I went to the restroom and came back, and the waitress thought that I was deaf because I use my hands so much when I speak. So I am aware of it being a thing. I was not aware of the sensitivity of the microphone.
Yeah, it's only the just that's just one of those things. When I was in, I went to Los Angeles and I studied acting, and mm-hmm. that's one of the things that I really worked on while I was there in my classes. Some of my, you know, all of my teachers would be like, if you pat your hands up and down like this, that's a choice, you know.
Right.
That can't be just something that goes unstated. If you see an actor on stage go like this, raise their hands up and then pat their thighs like they're angry, you know, it's it doesn't come off well, like ever, right. for instance. But a lot of people, or you know, tapping, like fidgeting, shifting from one side to the right, if you're standing on stand-up comedy, it's like that. All that stuff is apparent.
Mm-hmm.
And what actors
is there a psychology behind it?
It's just nervous motion.
Okay.
Like, I started playing drums and playing music originally in sixth grade because I had a lot of nervous motion.
Right.
And I needed some kind of way to channel it. So it's like when you discover you have it, you know, that just means you have this extra energy. But it also is nerves. You're nervous about something frequently, as the case, especially if you're not aware of it. Like, the first few stand-up shows I recorded of myself, I was just, like, pacing, walking, moving back and mm-hmm. forth, you know. And it doesn't look good. The audience has trouble following you.
Right.
It looks like you're nervous and not in control. And it's all subconscious. No one in the audience is going to say why they feel this way, why they're not paying attention, why they missed that last joke. But it's because they can't. So I worked in this technique where I would just stand there. You know, I would just do shows like, I'm not moving at all. These feet are staying here for 5 minutes. You know, I'm holding this microphone and I'm not going to wave my hands around. I'm not going to grab the mic stand and sit here and fidget with it with my left hand. You know, let's say they call it jerking off the mic stand. You see a lot of comedians do it, you know, on live shows and stuff. But in acting, like a great actor described by Chuck Palahniuk, like on the Fight Club set,
mm-hmm.
Chuck Palahniuk was watching Edward Norton
mm-hmm.
and Helena Bonham Carter. And mm-hmm. after it, he wrote about it and was like, you know, it was really inspiring just to see these people. Like, his every motion they made that was on camera was calculated.
Right.
There was nothing extra or superfluous, you know. You're like you become a little bit statuesque or whatever, but it plays really well on screen. But in, you know, in the bigger picture in life, not just in performance, I have like this spidey sense, you know. I can tell when someone is uncomfortable, nervous, not feeling themselves, and also I can sit there so motionless that it makes people, you know, a little uncomfortable, or alternately, like in your case, you know, it gives you freedom just to talk.
Right.
And get your story out, which is what, you know, one of the things I've been working on, I guess, the most is, or one of the things I've been working on the most is getting over this constant, like, over-talking, desire to over-talk and interject, and just being okay to passively observe and listen, take myself out of it, and quiet my voice, and then just let someone roll on. And that's, these are, you know, it's life skills. That are really helpful. You should learn that stuff in high school. You know, like, you can tell, how do you think people win poker games? You know, it's because people are obviously unaware that they're making all these motions.
Giving things away.
You're giving things away. And it's all, you know, self-control. Know yourself. You're the pilot of the vessel. And that's, I guess, you know, as a performer, that's part of it. It really is. Everything I do on stage now, you know, before I go on, it's, you know, it's been a few, but I don't have to think about that as much anymore. You know, I listen to my recordings now, and it's much more to the point.
Mm-hmm.
I look at my recordings. I like last year, I did marijuana legalization, a show at the marijuana legalization event at the Uptown.
Okay.
And I played it back. And I kept saying the same thing over again. Every time, like, something that went well, I'd be like, yeah, now we're talking. But I said, now we're talking, like, 10 times. I was unable to continue watching my own show on tape because I kept repeating this nervous phrase that actually meant, to me, it was going really well.
Right.
You know, but it makes this, the audience must have been, I don't know if they would have picked up on that. Like, why is he saying this over and over again?
That, or they think it's your catchphrase.
Or it's my catchphrase. And it's, now we're talking is not really a good catchphrase, I don't think. But I learned. But you're not going to watch a video of yourself or recording of yourself perform and not learn something.
I mean, I think that there's something beautiful about the inner critic. You know, I'm learning to embrace my inner critic. one of the philosophies that I've come across of late is called Wabi Sabi. It's a Japanese philosophy. Are you familiar?
No.
I am going to dig in here because I do have notes on it
that
are far better than anything that I could actually tell you. But
Wabi Sabi?
Yeah, Wabi Sabi. W-A-B-I-S-A-B-I. Yeah, and the idea is that you find beauty in the imperfection, that you embrace it as a matter of fact. The main sort of father of wabi-sabi, his very first sort of wabi-sabi task, where it was discovered, is he was asked to clean a Zen garden. I think maybe these are making noise too, so. And he got everything absolutely perfect and pristine, and at the very end, he walked up to the cherry tree and shook it so that the leaves would just fall down, just so. And in seeing the beauty in the imperfection, you actually see the beauty of everything as it is. Not that you shouldn't work to be whatever that false vision of perfection is. I mean, you should always work on your craft. You should always try and make it better. But not beating oneself up when something isn't exactly right.
The beating oneself up, you know, like, I beat myself up a lot, and I wonder if, like, all the imaginary reason, or the things that I imagine are what other people might be thinking. And I wonder how often they really are thinking that.
Well, I mean, the thing that I always sort of embrace, and I know sometimes, like, people don't agree with this, but it's none of my business what other people think of me. I have got to be okay with myself. I'm the one who I wake up with, who I go to sleep with every single day. And if I am not okay with something, that's more important to me than somebody else. Finding the way to actually vocalize it to somebody is the trick. It doesn't always come easily, and it's one of those things where it could be tricky because you don't want to hurt somebody else's feelings if they're coming at you or what have you. But moreover, it's not even about your relationship with anybody else. It's about your relationship with yourself.
So wabi-sabi would then counsel me in this show where I said, now we're talking over and over and over again. It would be like, strive to be better. Yeah, I can't do that every performance, but let's just accept where I was at.
Yeah.
And look at it and try and grab the good that was in that performance. And I can do that.
Yes.
I can see. And then, well, if you look at my place, like around here, you happen to be able to see pretty much my brain splayed out across the whole room here. You know, I'm not planning to get a bunch of other extra decorations or something. This is really the way I like it to be. I can imagine maybe some tapestry over here in this corner around the back. But otherwise, you know, maybe one or two pictures. But, like, it's not, okay, I don't think I'm OCD. I don't think everything's in a place where I can find it, but it's not, you know, all lined up. You know, it's not spick and span. I do believe there's a healthy jumble that it can be. But stuff like, there's some things, though, that I'm like, that's too much. I can't handle like this. I couldn't, I don't like things leaning on top of other things. This would drive me crazy. That would drive me crazy. That's got to be put an end to. There's nothing, that's wrong right
My
there.
House would make you insane.
I just put a CD case up over PlayStation 3 and it just leans there up against us. I cannot have it. There's like a pin on top of my chapstick. You know, it's like, no, put the chip, lay it flat. I don't know why. It's just instinctual. I don't think it's an obsession, but my aesthetic requires this.
Well, I think there is something to be said about Zen minimalism. It is something every year I strive for. I happen to live in a fairly chaotic world. I've got these children that are little tornadoes of stuff. Like, they leave a trail behind them. Destruction in their wake. Mm-hmm. In a cute way, mind you. As only a mother can love. And then animals and life all around. So I find my own personal balance in the storm. I've got like a little area of the bedroom that is where I practice my yoga. I've actually got a little music studio set up there. And that's my little calm place. Everything else is in just whatever disarray it's in. I mean, we've lived in this house for 10 years and a lot of stuff has accumulated. I am dreaming of a dumpster. I know, like, some people have dreams of, like, I want to go to Tahiti. I want to fly. I want a dumpster. I want to throw all that shit out. Get it out of my life.
It can be done.
I know. I know. I just, I need time off. I need the little bit of money that it's going to take to get said dumpster. Perhaps a couple of hands to do so. I know it's possible.
It makes a huge difference emotionally to clear out space to make it more open and to, like, shrink the number of objects and stuff that your brain has to process all the time, I find. And so sometimes I go over to someone's house, I can just be overloaded.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and throw in the cat and the hair and the...
Oh, yeah.
And then, well, and the kids,
it's four cats and a dog right. and a soon-to-be ex-husband. There's some... I can't remember who said it, it's going to make me nuts. It might have been Salvador Dali, but there was something about live neatly in your day-to-day life so that you could live wildly in your art.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's what I do. Yeah. And then that's... it's kind of like... follow the little laws so you can break the big ones.
Right.
Similar, but I do believe that. Yeah, there's nothing, like, I'm not going to, I got this apartment about 2 months ago, and I had these lists of things I wanted to put in there, like this TV and, like, these chairs, and I built that table over there, the monitor stand, so, and I've really built out my imagination to the point where, yeah, I've got, you know, after February rent, you know, 50, 60 bucks to my name until unemployment starts rolling in. That's not going to be a lot, but there's nothing on my acquisition list. I want a curtain there to replace these stupid Venetian blinds that don't block the light, and they're going to break. But otherwise, this, you know, everything else that I want is our tool to create art. Video right. cameras, you know, lighting, stuff like that, or to pay people to be in my videos, stuff right. like that. Those are... I could, like, that camera that I want has been on my list for 10 years, you know. I've pretty much always wanted to spend about $3,000 in a camera since I was about 28. Mm-hmm. And I have not been able to do that. And so that now, like, is so overarching of my list of desires that everything else pales in comparison.
Right.
Maybe besides maybe a girlfriend, you know. Yeah. But the camera, a girlfriend, if I had to choose right now, artistically, that's, man.
Well, the camera will last a lot longer.
Statistically, probably. I mean, that's a little bit of a gamble. Warranty issues, you know, yeah. But you've got to wonder, like, yeah, really? You know, like, as an artist, you make these decisions.
I have a guitar that I've had, I mean, and this is going to give away a little bit on my age, but I've had a guitar... since 1989 that I've had a better relationship with than I've had with pretty much any other man that I've ever had in my life. And I slept with that guitar for years and reached over to it in the middle of the night and it sang songs to me and I sang songs back to it. And it's still like the most fulfilling relationship that I've had aside from my children.
Is that a fair comparison though? You know, like I wonder if, that's Gina. Well, I talked about that too in a previous issue. She was trying to, she's trying to write. Oh, sorry, our previous issue episode, the episode two. Yeah. Gina and I talked about this.
I listened to them all. Not in totality, but I listened to a majority of them all. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's excellent. And well, you know more about me than her. Anyway, I think that people are going to know me pretty well by the end of listening to a few of these podcasts. But the. Like, because she wants to write, but then she gets involved in romantic entanglements that, you know, for her, like, she's, you know, 64, she said, but still these guys are just coming to get with her. And then, you know, like a while back, someone said, I read this one time in a Salon article or something, that a lot of people in our generation, my generation, XY, millennium, whatnot, I'm not sure, I'm a little before that, I also am, you know, older, and... like, I remember 1989 pretty well, you know.
Okay,
I was there.
Good. That's why I was there.
That's why I started playing drums, you know. Perfect. They handed me a pair of drumsticks, and then I got this drum pad over here, which I still have.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's been... Is that an octopad, or what?
It's the octopad over there, yeah. I've had that since I was, like, 12.
Nice.
And, yeah, and that's, like, so precious, because I've, you know, to me, because it's a $40 object that I've spent countless hours with, you know. And,
hence, again... Why getting the camera is better than a girlfriend.
Right, if a girlfriend was like, you know, I can handle everything with this octopad.
Like,
right?
Sayonara.
Yeah, that's it. But they say, so you get involved in this big relationship in your 20s or 30s, but then people who are artists eventually decide they have to shed that, or it's not working out. There's something they're not able to commit to entirely, or the other person says they're not entirely in the relationship equally, or something doesn't work out with the balance of it. Because relationships and art, I think, are very difficult to be, are difficult. It's tricky. And for me, I think it's because my experience was, when you have a significant other and you're going to do something that's really loud, it reflects on them. And so you have to get into this recalculation phase. You know, can I go on tour? Can I tell this joke that might offend them? What's the next project that's going to work on? You know, that's going to make money. If I have to tell my girlfriend's parents what I'm working on, which of these projects will be the one that they would be most impressed by?
Right.
And then I got into that, and it totally shut me down at a time in my life when I was like, really was most on the spot to produce, because
right.
I had this girlfriend, had it all together, graduated, now do something wonderful. And here
right.
I was just, you know, getting halfway into projects and not able to, I was totally stuck. I got out of the relationship and it wasn't immediate, but then, you know, and it has always felt like this huge loss, but I think that my voice that I have right now never would have developed had I not made that sacrifice.
I think that that's part of the whole thing, is that you have to look at every little shitty situation that you go through and use it as fertilizer, because you wouldn't be who you are if you didn't have these experiences, good, bad, ugly, whatever. And being at peace with who you are gives you the opportunity to, like, let it come out. That's at least where I am. Because I would say, out of all of the songs that I've written, 90% of them are about relationships. So if it wasn't for the relationships going one way or the other, I mean, like, it's very Taylor Swift of me.
A little bit, yes.
But it's true. I mean,
the
like,
first one, you know, like,
it's true. I mean, like, even in the context of that rock musical that I'd written with my friend Michael, I think there are 11 songs in the song cycle, and two of them were written specifically about Joan of Arc. All of the rest of them were written about my personal relationships. It had nothing to do with Joan of Arc. Funny enough that, like, they should align in the storyline. Funny enough that the emotional piece was there, but never really thought about Joan of Arc when I was writing the song that's actually the one that she burns in.
Well, I mean, what's his, are you familiar with Into the Woods?
Yes,
Sondheim. Well, Stephen Sondheim, I never met Rapunzel, you know,
right.
Like, there has to be something else that was going on with him.
Right.
To give him these kinds of emotions, you know, that's one of the greatest pieces of art, I think. And, like, the breadth and the scope of those songs, like, in human experience, is really, you know, like the Eiffel Tower of music, in my opinion. The philosophically and stuff like that. Like, how do you, like, you know, where's that inspiration come from? Or, Joss Whedon, like, I probably won't mention this on more than one of these podcasts, but he was on This American Life,
mm-hmm.
on their live episode, and he sang a song called Pick, Pick, Pick It Apart.
Huh.
About how he felt like people were trying to psychoanalyze him as to why these characters do these things in his shows, like Firefly, Buffy,
right.
the Vampire Slayer.
Right.
And it made it, you know, and he's kind of like, you guys are, why? Well, you're taking all the fun out of it.
Right.
You know, because you're overanalyzing whatnot. But we, as artists, have to wonder about our motivations. And I guess I would challenge you maybe to seek out other subject matters, so it's not always...
I don't know. It's worked pretty well for me. I just wrote something else this week that was really... that I love. And I think that if I were... And I had a conversation with another friend of mine who is a playwright and a writer, and I've been counseling him on some things of late. And the thing is if you are doing something, not that you shouldn't push your boundaries, I think you should always be as deep in the water as only your toes touching the ground. Never set yourself up to drown. Hmm. However, be authentic to yourself. Just be at that teetering point. So if the things that really inspire me are these relationships and how we interact with each other, if that's what keeps me writing, if that's what keeps... I mean, you can't see this on the podcast, and you probably could barely see it here, but this is an organized journal. Like, each of these, like
it, with tabs,
it's colored got tabs. It's got colored tabs based upon,
it looks like it's from 1800, though.
Well, huzzah. But it's like, you know, it's got all of these different things that I'm working on. So, I'm serious. It's like gratitude, the key, the divorce, orbits, which is another thing that I'm working on.
Miscellaneous. A little bit.
Well, I mean, I let it out, and then I've got to figure out how do I synergize the themes. Where do I, because I don't want to like have, oh, this is a notebook for this and this is a notebook for that.
Right.
And I don't necessarily always want to do things electronically because I'm fascinated by the phone. I did not come up in the time of social media. So like some of it is still a little bit foreign to me. Somebody asked me the other day, do you have an Instagram account? And I'm like, I think so. I don't know that I've actually put anything on.
You don't even know
there.
If you have an Instagram account. That's a new one.
We were actually talking, well, apparently I do. And then Twitter, like it's just all too much.
If but it you was still... All like you haven't totally adopted all that. You have to have an anchor in the paper.
There's something viscerally satisfying about putting my hands on something like a fine, unlined notebook where I can sketch.
The dumpster.
Excuse me.
Yeah, but I have a wonderful balcony overlooking the most beautiful dumpster in all of Kansas.
I wish it was in my driveway.
Right? Yeah, that's exactly what you want. Huh?
I know. See?
Well, let's get a truck. Come over, guys, and everybody else does. That's why it's full all the time. Everyone knows that Muncie Hills. Go fill up their dumpsters with our junk.
All the best ideas happen right here. no, but there's something like so satisfying about just the pen to paper. I like sitting in a coffee shop. I like sitting, I've got like a little place that I go to when it's warmer out at Longview Lake where I will sit and meditate and listen to the fish jump in and out of the water early in the day. It's just that whole experience of allowing yourself to be the lightning rod that I think you're meant to be. It's quieting your mind down enough that you can listen and then take what you're hearing from the universe, as it were, and put it down into something that actually makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, make it coherent, you know. So it's like you're distilling your experiences, all the stuff you're seeing around you. And I don't mean to say that, you know, there's some kind of rule you can't only write about relationships, and then, but what you're describing is similar. I think the same thing in different ways. You may like a fish pond. I like my walk-in closet. I like to be.
Everybody's got their something.
You know, maybe you know. I've had too many roommates recently over the last year or two who've been around my space. I haven't had this type of like solitude and quiet, and just the idea that I can go in the back room. Not just behind one door, but behind like three doors now, you know, and get that type of quiet and that type of peace. That's what I've been doing. And that's where my little sit spot is. And that's
kind of fascinating. You're like, you go to the lake and I go to my walk-in closet, but everybody's got their zen zone, right?
I want to be quiet. I don't want there to be any, I don't want to be worried about somebody knocking on the door. I mean, I hope eventually to get out of that where I don't feel like I need to, where I feel like I'm, when you have that many roommates, you know, people in the last year have banged on my door, screaming, yelling at me, threatened to call the police on me, you know, barged into my room after I got out of the shower. Not unlike how you came in this morning. No, worse than that. Like, where you have a roommate and they feel free just to open the door to your space without knocking.
Right.
Like, what universe are you from, dude? You know, after that happens to you a few times, you know, where you're paying for that room and they're just coming into your space, you know, you that's so I'm kind of healing, I think, from that a little bit.
You got a little PTSD from the lack of personal space. Mm. Yeah, a lot of roommate situations just sort of break down into a whole lot of awful, whether it's like you ate food off of my shelf without replenishing, or for the love of God, flush the toilet, put the toilet paper back, you know, yeah. And all of the little things that kind of add up and make you batty.
But you're in the opposite, you're the other direction. You know, the people that are in your space are like, you know, your spawn. You know, they're your...
I made them. I'm like, it's totally, like, there's no personal space there either.
And you're like, kind of like the boss, too. So you're in control a little bit.
They're at that age where it's questionable.
They're questioning. I guess you'll never...
They're very smart. I mean, and it's not just as their mother that I'm saying this. There's actual, like, data that shows that their IQs are on the sort of extreme end of the bell curve.
Well done.
Yeah, you know, I had some genetic help from their dad. But, you know, when they're on that end of the bell curve, they're a little bit more closely aligned to the kids on the other end of the bell curve than the ones in the center. They require some special attention, mm-hmm. not in a, like, a major way, but they need to have their minds occupied so that they continue to use them for good and not for evil.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, not unlike adults. I guess if you know the devil's, what is it, the idle hands or the devil's
playground?
That's, that's the principle applies even if you don't believe in the devil, which is to say, you know, bored people fuck shit up.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I also want to commend you for continuing with your artistic process despite the kids. You know, I know a huge struggle, and it's a huge fear for me. How would I ever continue to do what I do if I had a child? And then I know so many people who get the kids, and then it's just the art is out the window.
Well, it's a truth for me. Like, I stopped playing because I couldn't use my hands. Like, I played the last show when I was pregnant, and then being pregnant with twins, I may have mentioned this already, like, everything just swole up. Like,
yeah,
I just got huge.
You can only imagine.
Yeah, yeah, like, you literally look 3 months further along than you are. Yeah, right. So by the time I was done, I looked like I was 12 months pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
Literally, it was ridiculous. I put them to full tilt. But it did go away. I did sing to them, but the writing wasn't there.
Was it like you went, did it... I mean, so there was a, you know, like 8 years or so where you felt like
you have
did
nine.
You feel like it was something was missing during that time, or was it like, you know, I've made this sacrifice, I'm coming back to it, it'll be there when I come back to it?
I think I filled my life up with so many other things, you know, just especially when they're little.
And you had that job during that whole
time. I started the job when they were two, and to add sort of to the bananas of it all, I nursed twins for 16 months.
How many is usual? Is that more months than usual? I don't know anything.
Well, I mean, there's no right answer here, but going over a year in general is, some people go a month.
Abnormal?
Well, it's, I mean, depending on, like, who you're talking to, like, some people, like, nurse until they're five. I'm proud of the fact that I nursed them as long as I did.
Do you like Game of Thrones? Do you watch Game of Thrones?
Yes!
There's that, 14-year-old still nursing?
Mommy's going to fly. Sansa Stark's auntie the Eyrie.
Right. Above the moon door.
Exactly. Mommy flew at the moon door. So sad. No, seriously, like, no, I was not going to ever do that because they did get to a point where they were disinterested and they would literally, like, somebody would walk in the room and they'd be like, that. I just couldn't do it. It was getting a little annoying. But so, you know, just the lack of sleep. You know, I was talking to some friends about this because I, you know, especially with the insomnia, it's like I just stopped raging against it. Like, saying I'm so tired all the time takes more energy than just being like, you know what, this is how my life is. I'm embracing the exhaustion and I'm going to figure out a way to exist within it. Which really benefited me, obviously past the nursing, back into the rock and roll world. I was off for 2 years while the venue I worked for was under reconstruction, and it worked out perfectly. They asked me to come back.
Cool.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But then
that turned out to be something that...
Well, it turned into something totally different, yeah. I mean, like, it wasn't what I anticipated.
What's, so the job was different when you...
Well, yeah, in my original role, I was booking and settling shows and doing production. And at the end, I was doing, like, ticketing management, which is, like, ass work.
Yeah, it's like the accounting.
Well, it's accounting, but it's also, like, building shows and shows, like, it's different, like, you know, whether it's price structure or figuring out, like, we need to make X amount of money for this, and we've got X amount of seats, and if we do this percentage at this price, and this percentage at this price, and this percentage at this price, and then, yeah, and then we've got all of these packages. Where are we going to put these packages? And, we've got 17 different pre-sales.
It doesn't really rock. Like, it was not rocking.
It really sucked. And it was not where I wanted to be. I mean, like, one of the reasons why I was excited about starting the job is we had access to the venue. And one of my coworkers and I were in a band together called Sweet Kitty. And we would, after hours, sit beneath the glow of the ghost light on the stage and rehearse in this beautiful hall with incredible acoustics that was meant to be like when it opened, there were no speakers or any of the sound system kind of stuff that we have nowadays. It was really one of those houses that, like, you're supposed to project to the back of the auditorium. And, like, you really could get beautiful natural acoustics in the room. So it was a wonderful place to rehearse. And so that was, like, really the exciting thing about that at first, and then it just kind of evolved and morphed, and I got comfortable in security, and here, have some benefits, we're gonna keep you safe, ooh, here's a bonus every now and again for the abuse we put you through. It's kind of it's fine. It's like, it seemed like a good idea at the time. I'm glad I went through it. I'm glad I now know what I cannot go back to.
They say that, I heard this quote recently that I think applies. I've heard it in different forms before. Like, Things Fall Apart, that's a famous novel by Chinua Achiuwa I read in high school, and it has affected my life that I read that, you know, that we all have this feeling, we all spend our lives trying to build up this, like, death of a salesman, like a network of people who are going to basically come to our funeral if we die, or that we'll be at the, you know, the, I don't know, the big shot at the open mic, I don't know, whatever your goals are, but things fall apart. No matter what we do, entropy is a force that we can only barely resist against on a good day. And over the course of our life, you know, we're going to see this arc. And we, like, our instincts, it appears to us like we'll be able to stand against it, but it's inevitable, and, you know, it's like thermodynamics. You can't have a perpetual motion machine. It's against the whole nature of the universe for it to go otherwise. And so then the only thing that you can do is be aware of it falling apart when it falls apart. Because the worst thing is when you're trying to grab onto something that's disappearing and going away no matter what. And you're caught by surprise.
Right.
Or, you know, not ready for it or whatever. So, I mean, that's when... So when I lost this job on New Year's, New Year's Eve, like it was like the, you know, the acceptance, like the denial acceptance process was like 12 hours. You know, in my mind, I had built up this 10 years of this job. Okay, and then in June, I'll be able to get that camera, finally.
Right.
You know, and then at the end of the year, I'll have made this music video, and I'll just be going 8 to 5. You know, they won't know a single thing about my artistic career.
Right.
And I'll be channeling all this office cubicle money into all this beautiful art money, and then, who knows, maybe I'll get a boat, you know, whatever.
Right.
Five years from now, then no girl will be able to resist me. We'll have all of my ducks in a row, a boat and music videos and the camera, you know, then I'll be great. And then you're fired. I'm sorry, you're not working out here in the long term. There we, and why? We're not telling you. But it's probably your burlesque song that you printed on the printed at the office printer. That was a definitely bad professional judgment. We're not going to bring that up, though, because there could be legal ramifications. Or that's their ace in the hole in case I sued them for unlawful termination, whatever they want it to be. But then at 12 hours, I recognized that, hey, this was boring as hell. You know, this would have been 10 years of me learning professional skills that have no use outside of a price chopper. You know, like, this is... And also, it was taking about 10% of my abilities, you know.
Right.
Why would I want to, why do I want to hang on to that just out of some sense of security? So I recognized then that, you know, there's no reason to grab onto this. You know, I did what I was supposed to do. It was all normal business stuff except for my song. And, but then also recognize the truth of the situation. You know, a tiger can't change its stripes.
Right.
It's only so long that I'm going to be able to sit in a cubicle before people catch on that there's only they're only seeing 10% of what's going on with me.
Still waters run real deep.
See, and I, you know, that's, you know, I, you know, that's how I live my life. But if you look at the stuff I post on my cubicle, it's all this stuff about the artistic motivation, you know, that helps me get through this boring cubicle time. Like one of Conan O'Brien's quotes, it's also really applicable here, that he said this quote, I can't get it word for word, but there is profound opportunity in failure. You know, if you like losing out on a goal, not getting what you want, if you sit in that moment and examine it and mine it, then it can be the beginning of a profound, it can really be a profound beginning,
right,
a reinvention,
regenerative,
the stuff that you can come out of that. And, you know, so I get fired. I did all the remaining psychedelic drugs that I had.
But could have either worked out well or badly.
It was a test for me, you know. Usually I would, you know.
Can I ask what it was?
Oh, LSD.
Okay.
And, yeah, now here I am internationally, you know. Mm-hmm. Letting everyone know the type of stuff that I do, but yeah, it's,
or at least did on New Year's Eve once.
I wasn't on New Year's or New Year's Day. I went to holidays, but it was like, I took all that I had, which is a hefty dose, and it was alone. You know, I've tripped alone before, several times. It's not the ideal thing to do, but, you know, you're gonna deal with your stuff.
Right.
You know, you're gonna get over this, and, and it's a challenge. You know, you have to keep your mind in the right place. Otherwise, you can go down the spiral of negative thinking or panic and think you're talking with demons.
So did that happen?
No.
Okay, good.
No, but really, I haven't had any problems like that on psychedelics.
Really?
Since I,
there's nothing in there.
Oh, okay. Since I got my Buddhism trip in order.
Awesome.
You know, it's all just like, any of those bad thoughts that you have or panics that I've had even, it's just like you take refuge in the excellence of the Buddha.
Right.
You say, like, this is, you know, and you can see that as either Buddha is this immortal being among many that are out there that are just kind of on your side helping you and protecting you in kind of a spiritual way, that the way that formal Buddhism sees Buddha is kind of like a Jesus figure. Or you're just taking refuge and shelter in the excellence of the ideas. That just by paying attention, if all worse comes to worse, just watch your own breathing for 20 minutes, you know, and everything else, just go back to the breathing, just having that one technique, you know. And before I did Vipassana, I was aware of that, because I'd had panic attacks, and I knew that I had this propensity in certain situations to hyperventilate and not think right, you know. And but, you know, I'd always, like, when I quit cigarettes, that's what I've had to get in really under control. Because, you know, whenever I didn't have a cigarette, I would get this hyperventilation. Like, But then I would be like, okay, whenever that happens, all I have to do is just take deep breaths. But Buddha takes a step further. You know, like, really, pay attention to every hair in your nostril. Like, every sensation of the actual breathing. The air on the lips, the air on the inside of the nose, the air coming into the lungs. And just focus on that. All those, like, millions of sensations. Is you can just always go back to that.
Yeah, there's an articulation in every single moment, down to the most microscopic, you can feel it. Part of yoga is pranayama. It's one of the many branches, and that is specifically dealing with the art of breathing.
Anapana in Vipassana is what they call it.
What do they call it?
Anapana.
Anapana. Interesting. Pranayama Anapana.
I yes, like right. And it, like some of the fancy words, you know, I'm a lot of time I want to call yoga just stretching. And like Bikram yoga, stretching, but really hot. You know? Like it's these fancy words make it seem really pretentious. Like we're learning something exotic and stuff like that. When really you're just stretching. Really you're just breathing. Really you're just sitting there.
Right, but I mean there are certain techniques that come along with each of them that like they call each of the areas that that you open up your bandhas. So like you can feel like, you know, when I breathe now after learning, like I can breathe. It feels like all the way down to my lowest chakra, like all the way down to the spine, the base of my spine. And then at each sort of juncture, whether it's a chakra point or actually a musculature functionality of your body, I can like squeeze each of those bandhas and like stop the air like from coming up throughout. It's kind of amazing.
Sometimes there'll be words that there's no translation for. Yeah. This is true.
The same I don't know with what Yiddish.
That's a brilliant thing for a language to have, to invent words that we haven't. Like if you, like the English language has a lot of words in it. And if you, like if you read Cormac McCarthy or something like that, you know, there's like more words than you can shake a stick at that you've never even heard before, or this SAT, you know, something like that. But there really are in Eastern traditions, they have some words where our Western minds haven't even, you know. Like Vipassana means body scanning in art. But really body scanning, no one wants to say that. It doesn't make any sense. It means that you're just like, you know, consciously looking at every part of your body and just listening for any type of sensation up and down, head to toe.
Is it a visual scan or is it like an internal scan?
Internal scan.
Okay, like that I understand.
Visual scan would be a different type of meditation. Like, oh, look at this
I
hair.
I still got five toes.
Oh, look at all these hairs on my ankle. Oh my gosh, that's more than I thought.
Me too. It's the winter. I'm not shaving my legs.
Well, you know, here it is. All bets are off.
That's right.
Well, and so but we have then the word Vipassana, and that is in a way a matter of respect. I don't mean to say let's throw all these words out entirely, but a lot of the time with yoga and meditation, you know, I want to, and I talk about this with Mighty Sparrow Etwa, because she's also a shaman, and she's a shaman, and she has seen so much of like the new agey healing stuff, you know, where you set yourself up with this business card and this picture of you in your yoga pose, and then you start charging $100 an hour for special healing services or whatnot, and then like the price of it and the fanciness of it attracts all these, you know, types of people.
The people who work in offices that are looking for
looking for something in all the wrong places, right, without wanting to make any type of actual commitment besides a financial one.
Right.
And I mean, without having any type of intellectual...
I believe that the people that are doing it may actually have the abilities for themselves. What I question sometimes and makes me wonder, you know, especially when it becomes like a good in trade, is if it really is more of a snake oil kind of situation, because so much of it has nothing to do with what's happening externally. It's got to do everything with what's happening internally. Mm. However, I will say that I was gifted Reiki for my birthday this year by a very, very dear friend. And I'd never had any Reiki done before, and there are certain aches and pains that I had beforehand that I do not have anymore.
Really? I mean, it's like I'm not trying to throw all of it out the window.
It's and a neither certain, am I. I
a
think...
certain type of, and that's to say, and yeah, I to believe that this stuff is possible. And but it, there's only like a certain, like these, you know, there's of course healers and massages, therapists, and people who can do acupressure really well that all help you. And just there in the Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha book, Daniel Ingram, who, you know, I'm a fan, he calls it, in Buddhism, there's a thing like that too, he calls it the Buddhist jet set culture, which are the people who put on all like the $10,000 CEO, you know, weekend getaway things, all the fancy, you know, ashrams in California and New York. And for which I would never hear about it. No one would ever tell me these places even exist. Like there's You know, there's middle tier ones that I've heard about that you can pay, you know, $1,500 for a month or something like that. But there does exist this higher tier of elite spiritual services that I find ridiculous, and that's why I ridicule it. I don't mean to say that it's all snake oil.
Everybody's got their journey.
But Reiki, I've never had that done before. That no one even touched you physically.
I wasn't even touched physically. And what's interesting is beforehand, because I've really been working on sort of protecting myself energy-wise, like building up a bit of a protective bubble, because I do get a lot of odd energy kind of thrown at me on occasion. But they had divining rods in front of me, and as soon as they pointed them at me, like, they just expanded, because it, like, he doesn't know me from Adam, but these divining rods, you know, they point them straight at you, and, like, depending on, like, what your energy field is like, it kind of goes in opposite directions. And he was shocked. He was like, that can't be true. But, I mean, I think that there is something to be said about people who are honing a craft. I don't know what they have to do to hone the craft of Reiki, and I honestly can't remember all of the things that they did to me in that 20-minute session. But my left knee, I have like a torn meniscus, and I was in severe pain for a long time. And now every now and again, I'll get a dull pain, but not nearly to the extreme that it was before. And I do yoga and other things, but to see a difference just in one day between that treatment and... You know,
and didn't come back.
No, I mean, it's like I've got, like, every now and again, I think, like, when the weather changes, I'll get a dull.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, age and decay.
Well, I wonder. I mean, well, that's when you've seen, like, there are certain types of things that you can see in life that make all of the atheist, pure reason people, you know, like, they can talk all day long. I've seen this happen. Mm-hmm. Like, I've had numerous predictive dreams that
Me too.
I wouldn't be surprised if everyone did, if they were paying attention. I don't see it. I'm not trying to claim I have some kind of special power, but when I lived in Hawaii, I would have these shark dreams. And when I woke up, I look at the newspaper, someone was bit by a shark. Like, every time I had a shark dream, there was an actual reported shark biting, you know? And
that's what happened.
They bite people in the morning while they're taking their morning swims. And all over the islands, if anyone's taking a morning, they're all Hawaiians, like, to go out in the morning and take their morning swim. Not all, but, you know, it's a pretty common thing to do. So they're getting bit by sharks all the time, one way or the other. But it was when I was there for a year, it happened 3 times.
Wow.
It was like, that was a terrifying dream. I woke up, oh, did you hear about the shark attack? And, like, for instance, there's been not just a few. You know, it's been a lot of different things where you see something that your reason can't really add up to. You know, I was living by myself. There was nobody next door to me yelling shark all night or something like that. There's no scientific, you know. But when you see that, then you, in our society, there are just some places where that can't exist. You know, like if you have a telepathic experience, if you have a predictive dream or intuition, things that seem like linear time isn't as real or solid as you think it might be, or that there's something in between, you know, that transmits ideas outside of the human body, for instance, or emotions or feelings, or at some kind of ceremony. If you go to a shamanistic ceremony and you feel something on your hands that you've never felt before, that's not heat or that's not, you know, I've just seen too much stuff like this. That for me to just throw all spirituality out the window and hop on board with Sam Harris and the pure rationalists, say it's a purely mechanical universe, there's no soul. You know, I've talked to people, some of my best friends are like, if you believe in the soul, I just think you're a yokel. You know, I think that you don't know how to think at all. You know?
There was something that I heard from a NASA physicist. It was kind of one of these videos that was going around. She was asked about, what is the meaning of life? And she said, as sentient carbon-based life forms, we are simply the universe experiencing itself. So we're just little pieces of carbon. If you want to call that little piece of carbon your soul, That is absolutely fine. And I think that that is the whole thing. It's like this, we are this piece of Carbon's journey. Whatever your package is, this, it's your journey. And as soon as I heard that, my heart kind of opened up. It just made sense to me. It's like, really, like, we are so insignificant in the scheme of our entire universe. You know, a flea on 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 a flea. Infinitely. Infinitely. Our universe is expanding. We have no idea. We have an idea based upon a speculation by, you know, the biggest brains in physics. But the fact that we put so much value and so much concern into, like, the minutiae, instead of taking care of each other, instead of loving each other, instead of being as happy as one can be, because I do truly believe that happiness is a choice. I think that you can choose to be miserable. There are days when I just can't shake it off. But I also know that there's something that I can do that makes me feel better. The point of this, I guess, being that we have to take a little bit of perspective on the grand scheme of things and figure out how to exist in a way that allows us to just accept the experiences that are given to us, whether it's good or awful, whether it's positive experience or negative experience, life, the beauty of life, the tragedy of death. We learn to live with these additions and these giant holes. And it's an incredible gift to be able to just kind of see it all for what it is, which is just the universe is full of all of these things. Incredible beauty, incredible tragedy, violence, love, all at once.
On a massive scale.
It is on a massive scale, but it's also like my friend Luke and I, over the course of the summer, the first podcast I ever listened to, and I'll not remember the name of the guy, but who hosted it, but a Franciscan monk named Richard Rohr was on it. Do you know who he is, Richard Rohr? Luke and I were talking about Hermeticism, you know, the as above, so below. So all of, and Richard Rohr talked about that as well. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. just like, if you can just see like that it's all happening at once, embrace it, and then just kind of figure out how to float your way through it all, you know?
Well, that is, I mean, but to get through life, you know, I don't mean to put you on the spot to like sum up all existence,
right?
Like what they say at the end of I Heart Huckabees, that mm-hmm. there's a. Are you familiar with I Heart Huckabees?
I have. Yes.
I'm a big. It's one of my favorite movies. It's maybe great. One of the most important movies, I think, intellectually, of the last 30 years or something. I think, because it's like, really, if a kid just grew up, like when your kids get to be 15 or 16, how are you going to explain them existentialism, transcendentalism? You know, it's not going to be like when we were in the 80s growing up, where those are like, you know, fancy things that French people talk about.
Oh, no, we talked about it.
You've already talked about it. They're 9 years old, and you've already had that discussion about it.
I don't talk down to my kids. Okay. I speak to them in, you know, real language. If they don't understand a word that I've said, they have the tools and the technology to look it up. If they can't figure it out on their own intellectually, just through context, which oftentimes they can. Mm-hmm. One of my daughters the other week said, "Mommy, I know all these words that I don't know why I know them." I'm like, "Because you read them or you heard them, and you are using it properly."
That's a real astute question. Like, how do I know this word? And you're like, you don't. They start to recognize. Wow, that's pretty deep. Because, like, how do I? I never asked that question. Where did I first hear this word? And if as a kid you're coming out of this like haze because your brain is in transition, then At the end of I Heart Huckabees, they have a conversation. They're trying to experience life and see what just life is in its purest moment-by-moment sensation. And they were hitting their face with balloons.
Okay.
Yeah, and it, like, reminded... That's just that momentary face feeling. Some people say it's like riding a motorcycle. Timothy Garden Motorcycle Main says that's the feeling you get with the wind in your face. Like, you can study the moment of that motorcycle vibrating of the wind in your face. But there's just going to be this maneuver sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so... There's only, like, the only, at the very core level, the only reaction that makes any sense to the manure is to try and plant something in it, to build something out of it. It's the only, so in, like, I was homeless 3 times in 2015.
Okay.
You know, like, I've got to move in, like, the next week. I don't have a place to go. You know, I'm working part-time for $12 an hour, solving everyone else's problems with their gadgets and their huge entertainment centers over the phone. And then I'm just getting kicked out because I can't, you know, roommates are being weird. And not all the roommates are weird, but enough of them in the last year, you know.
To all you roommates out there.
Yeah, really. Like, if it's less than $100 or around $100, you shouldn't be getting emotional about it. Right. You know, especially if someone's really trying. But that aside, that's the moment where you're called to the carpet. Do you really believe this stuff or not? Living when you're in the value place... unable to afford a $500 a month place,
right?
But you're homeless, so you have to pay $1,200 a month,
right?
Just to live in this place while you're working part time, you know. So you're in this cheeseball hotel with a bunch of day laborers, you know. And so what are you gonna do? Like, can you believe all this stuff about anapana, about the soul, about connectivity, the connectivity of everything, about all of the spiritual stuff that you can't see, you know, like, is there any greater purpose? Do I have anything that I can't see me that's forces or entities that are helping me, whatnot? That's the hardest thing. In fact, I don't even think that I would believe anybody's practice anymore about anything until they're facing homelessness, nearly that point, you know, and the other thing that would call it to question is the, you know, threat of death. Just like, this is it right now, you know. You could recant everything you want to, you know, like, there's, you know, if you're dying in the next hour or next day, you know, you got no reason to lie about anything.
Right.
You got no, and every reason to be like, am I totally sure that I didn't, you know, do a bunch of horrible stuff here that's going to kind of follow me whatever happens, to that I don't know what's going to happen? And I didn't do that well when I was in the value place, you know. I had a lot of really grim thoughts, like, maybe, you know, if I'm going to help everybody else out and this is the help that I get, you know, best friend can't even, you know, let me stay at his place even though he has this huge house, you know. People treat you, you know, it's all about how much money you got, not, you know, if you got a job or not necessarily, you know. And, like, so a lot of things that went really bad. And then all the denials on places to live, applications turned down, you know. And the best I could do was record songs. So in the value place, I recorded a demo of a song. You know, it's the best I could do. And also, I put myself out there. I said, Prim, could I do a feature for you at the open mic? I started saying, I've got to start going to this open mic and playing my music.
Wow.
And then that was a moment where, you know, I had no reason to be optimistic. But I said, hey, I made this song. I'm really proud of it. I recorded it in fucking value place in this one bedroom, you know, like, dormitory, you know, ridiculous place. And then I'm going to be the featured musician 3 weeks from now. I'm going to survive till then, one way or the other. And it was about a week and a half later that I, like, all you're doing is filtering Craigslist every day, looking for something that might work out. And about a week and a half later, I found some place I was able to move in for like $200.
Oh, great.
With a guy my age. You know, 3 months later, I'm like, I got to get out of this place. Right? But for that three months...
But it served a purpose.
It worked, yeah. Him and I aren't going to be great friends. He lives with so much dog hair, I almost lost it. But that was the last place I lived before I got my own place, which was my own. And everything at that time seems like it's moving in slow motion. Like, I'm doing all this work for all these other people day after day. I go out there and do this, plus all my artistic stuff that I get no compensation for or recognition for. And it just seems like for this whole year, and even the year before that, I was like that. I was taking care of my mom. She had Alzheimer's, and nothing's coming through for me. So it really wasn't until I got this apartment that I felt like, for like 3 years, I went through that in my late 30s now, where you have nothing to show for your entire life. Every girl's laughing at you because you can't, you know, you don't have your own place. You know, you're kind of a mess. And then it just seems like it took too long. You know, like that's the thing that's really trying about it. Is that the gears, if anybody was helping me, the gears are spinning slowly. Meanwhile, the capitalism is moving a little bit quicker.
I find a balance, though, like, in these things, because I have to exist in this capitalistic society. And believe me, there are times when I just want to give it all up and build a yurt in Alaska. Mm-hmm. It is...
can be done.
I know it can be done. That's why I'm like, I'm going to do it. My friend Michelle's like, oh, we'll grow some weed up there. It'll be fine. I'm like, you've got all the best plans.
You're so pretty cold in the tundra.
You know, well, I mean, but, you know, we would have a greenhouse. It'll be fine. But the artistic expression... like, expecting to make money off of it doesn't put you in the purest place of creation. It puts a tilt on it. It makes it something that it is not authentically when it comes out of you. I don't feel like you can really truly do it with having that as your goal. The reason why these megastars are doing what they do, and I know there was a meme that kind of went around that was similar to this, is like a Beyonce. Not that there's anything wrong with Beyonce, but she's got a team of hundreds mm-hmm. and hundreds of people mm-hmm. that she stands on the back of.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Hundreds.
Yep.
There was a meme specifically that was like one of her songs, I can't remember this, 16 people, 14 producers,
yep.
you know, all these people writing this shit song that's mm-hmm. got 5 lyrics mm-hmm. in it. And Freddie Mercury and one producer wrote Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, uh-huh. 89 chords in Bohemian Rhapsody. And then you compare that to somebody who's, you know, if you analyze the music, it's a remake of a Madonna song most of the time, one way or the other.
Right.
And then, yes. So we exist, you know.
This is I didn't what I know 89 chords in Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah, that's it's
pretty,
amazing.
Pretty fantastic. Like, I didn't hardly, the guitar grimoire, but yeah, it's a true... And you look at all. If I look at all of my favorite pieces of art, you know, there was this point of struggle where it seemed all seemed lost, mm-hmm. where there was no reason to go on with this thing. Fight Club, one of my favorite movies, mm-hmm. was that way. I Heart Huckabees was mm-hmm. that way. These are like two favorite movies. 100 different ways almost didn't mm-hmm. get made.
In 100 different ways.
Yeah. Red Pit basically.
I know, you just forced. Said 100, which made me laugh. Oh.
Right, that's a new word. Okay, inventing new languages here. 100 different ways. Extra.
It's very Yiddish.
And then, so I think, and then like James Murphy, LC Sound System, he said he's never been able to get into a band if he wasn't able to get into their story. Like why they, you know, what's going on with them. And it's like, the problem is, and Jackson the Harper and I talked about this as well, is that we, in our society, there's these huge, super rich musicians, and then everybody else is just a scrub open micer. You know, there's very few spots in the middle where you can be a sane person that's not trying to rule the freaking world and get by on your art and just make money and have how much, however many views or how many people enjoy your stuff translate into... just a couple extra $100 a month, for instance, is what most artists right. really want who are making their stuff. But that space doesn't exist at all. You're either going for the brass ring or go back to the open mic. You're not. You're just a fake. You're not really a musician or whatnot. And that exists in comedy, acting, writing, music, ballet, every single art in the United States. And it's endemic to a capitalistic system. So that's one of, I guess, my hobby horses, one of the things I want to talk about with everybody. You know, how can we... you know, get this less crap that's making millions of dollars and have more, you know, real artists get out, you know, have more space in our culture for that. And also, and in a lot of ways, this is happening. You know, crowd, Although for a lot of the time, it's people on Kickstarter just getting money from their parents in a different way.
Right.
The avenues exist there, and the people are thinking of these ideas. Whether or not they come from the same ideological area as me, or it's a critique of capitalism, the technology exists in ways for you to set up your own business model and have your own goals that are real and financial. And as Amanda Palmer, the Dresden mm-hmm. Dolls singer, says, it's okay to ask for help.
Yeah.
Ask for patronage and to be patronized as an artist.
But you know that she's also married to Neil Gaiman.
Yes. Right. Well, yeah, they're so financial.
She's got a little something going on there.
And I don't, she got $1.5 million from a Kickstarter for an album, you know, but right. I don't compete with, you know, women, I guess. That's kind of what I'm working on. How do I can ask for help without, you know, putting myself on such a low pedestal that it, you know, steals all my, I don't know, my mojo, I guess.
Yes, Funda.
Right. And I'm working on that. It's one of the ways, but it's got to happen because I do feel like, you know, I was doing the calculations the other day. If I've made, for my Social Security, how much it says that you've made above the table, what's on the mm-hmm. books, you know, it's a few $100,000 for 40 years of life. But the vast majority of my work hasn't been compensated for. So if this 10% is worth $300,000 or something like that, then the 90%, you know, all the screenplays, all the albums that no one listened to, all the books that wouldn't be looked at by a publisher, if all that stuff were compensated for, I have this well of karma that's worth millions.
Right, well, I mean, like...
And a lot of artists do, I think.
Like, Van Gogh was never compensated but for one painting in his lifetime. Yeah. I mean, that's... I'm going to let my nerd flag fly, but that's my favorite episode of Doctor Who, is when they take him to see his exhibit. Did you ever see that?
I did not watch that whole episode.
It's kind of breathtaking. It was very emotional because, I mean, like...
That whole idea, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I mean...
What did he say? Do you remember what he said?
He just couldn't even believe it. I mean, I got goosebumps thinking about it, but he just couldn't believe that anybody actually was doing that for him because they just thought he was crazy.
Yeah, and that's...
But that's the thing, is you do it for yourself. You can't do it for anybody else. I am, I think, more than anything, one of the motivations for me, aside from, like, having an avenue for expression, is to show my daughters that you can do the thing that brings you joy, no matter how old you are. Like, nothing can take it away from you. There are a million things that will try to derail you from the thing that you love. And here I am saying, I am a mother. I'm in my 40s. I lost a corporate job that paid well but did not serve me well. I manage a restaurant and I am doing this thing that feeds my soul, or it is how my little piece of carbon needs to express itself in this vast universe. It's got a few different ways that it needs to express itself, but this is the way that is most natural right now.
And from that perspective, it seems like the true artist will do it even if they're not making any money.
I think that that's the thing. It's like, you're not doing it because you're going to get compensated. I think that filters it in a really sort of spoiled way, for lack of a better word. It makes things tinged with what do they want rather than what do I need to express.
That's the opposite. So many people would, like in LA, you know.
Well,
I'm trying to get these attitudes out of my head that were kind of ingrained in me while I was out there. People who are regulars at comedy clubs will refer to people who go to the open mic as open micers. And they're not really comedians. You know, they're not really. That's one of the reasons I like the musical open mic better. On any given night, I would rather go to a musical open mic and do musical comedy than do just normal stand-up at a stand-up open mic.
Yeah, I've never seen your regular stand-up, but your songs are fucking hilarious.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, in a way, I think there's more of a demand for musical comedy, or I can do that then when 90% of the other comedians can't do that, right. So why shouldn't I do that? Yeah. I should focus on the thing I can do. And it's, and I feel a little bit in a straitjacket with normal comedy because, you know, there's formal stuff there that I feel like I want to break all the time. Mm-hmm. But when I can do the musical thing and more of a stage show, then I get really inspired as all the possibilities. But when I was, you know, out there, you know, the reason I like the musical open mic, no one at a musical open mic is saying to the other musicians, you're not a real musician. You're just an open micer.
Right.
You know? Doesn't exist. That doesn't happen. If you go to the comedy open mic, go, what's this, your first time? Or, like, have you ever gone on the road? You know? And you're not
that. I guess musicians will put up with more questionable stuff. Is that what you're saying?
I guess.
Because there's some questionable things.
That I don't think are good. Well, they're good art, but people, it's effort. You're putting yourself out there. You can't go up there with a guitar and sing something without showing your heart a lot. Or, yeah. And you can't go up there and just posture. You know, you can't go up there, and a lot of guys do that. They'll get really chummy with their other comedian friends, and they go up on stage, and they just go, yeah, and they talk about what it's like to be an open mic comedian for their whole five mm-hmm. minutes, and I'm just like, what are you even talking about? Why are you doing this? Or it's all self-referential navel-gazing or whatever. Not all the time, but frequently. And then
there's a little bit of that.
So musicians, if you can at least show me that you spent the hours to know what a chord is, you know, it's difficult for me to say, get out of town, put that thing down or whatever. And, just a more encouraging atmosphere. I went to one of the open mics one time, and I got all this attitude. I put my name in the hat, didn't even get on the list. They interrupted my last joke, I don't think for any real reason, for instance, like that. Nothing. Go to the open mic night. Prim's just like welcoming, open arms, you know, friendly, yes. All the other musicians.
Yes.
I just made a bunch of friends over and over, like friend after friend after friend after friend, and the opposite happens at the open mics. Everyone's like, get out of my limelight. Who do you think, are you in my clique or not in my clique? I'm like, you guys are not acting like normal humans. This is not authentic behavior. And so, that's one of the reasons that I'll go that way. But in general, the attitude of this podcast and my attitude and an idea that I'm trying to amplify, because it's a good idea, is that you have to, if this whole idea where you encourage artists or say, get out of town, you're not good enough, you're not the real deal, you're just pretending, you don't get anything out of that attitude. You're just telling people not to create something that I'll enjoy.
Right.
Shrinking the amount of things that are out there that you could watch on your TV or on the radio or whatever. Whereas if you encourage an artist, even somebody who's so bad that they're annoying to you, you have this possibility for a great thing.
The artist that you had talked about with Jackson on that podcast.
Oh, yeah, right.
I actually was getting ready to leave, and his friend said he really liked your set, and he would like for you to hear. I was like, that's really sweet. And so, like, mm-hmm. I stayed, and I weathered it. You know, there are things that you can say to people that aren't hurtful, but are still, encouraging and possibly directive in a way that is still positive. So I remember telling that kid that he was really far out, because he really was.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of Tiny Tim involved in there. But, you know, Tiny Tim actually made a living off of it. I don't know. So, I have a quote that's on my phone that I look at every day, and it reminds me of something you just said, which is, if you want to be tough, if you want to be rebellious, if you want to be a badass, then show your heart to everyone. Everyone. Mm. So I think that that's kind of the thing. It's like having the balls to just get up there and expose your beating heart, essentially. I mean, like, your songs are funny, so I don't know if it's really a beating heart. But, like, all
more
of my...
than you might realize.
It comes from somewhere that's real for you, obviously. And, like, you express it in a humorous way. I express these songs of love and loss and hubris and heartbreak in the way that works for me, but it's still exposing, like, the crux of who you are.
Hmm. I did really feel that when I watched you perform, that I definitely had a strong feeling that you're putting it all out there. And in fact, I had a little bit of a hallucination. I have this thing where I imagine people in like either music videos or films.
Okay.
Everybody I know, everybody I work with, I run across, I kind of cast them in a certain way and I start to write a story. What would their story be like? Mm-hmm. And at various times in my life, I've invited people to be a prop. I've said, people who aren't an actor at all. I mean, like, you know, I wrote this story about you. How do you like it? And no one ever wants to indulge me in this. But with you, I thought, you know, I had this idea. I said, if she came on the podcast, you were wearing your red jacket. Mm-hmm. And I just had one of those, like, if we had a green screen behind you, you know, and it was just like, you were like some kind of avatar of the wood elf spirit or something like that. But in the 22nd century,
I've been called, you know, worse things.
Like behind you, there's like, you know, just like a, like you're flying over a forest
through Endor.
Maybe a little bit like that. There's like a, and then there's just you, and it's cheesy, you know, like you're in a karaoke video that they play at a karaoke show. Sweet. Or something like that. You're sitting there, it's got this green screen, but you got this red jacket, and you're just like belting it out, and like the plane is just soaring over this jungle. Over, you
just
know.
Tell me when and where you want me to take me there, I'll right. do it.
In a different...
Somebody told me I look like a superhero in that jacket.
Yeah, you do. That's exactly what I was thinking. You know, you're an avatar, you're representing the, basically Joni Mitchell in, you know, as the
21st century,
the 21st
Joni
century,
Mitchell.
Just be like, you know, it doesn't, in this, you know, this doesn't have to be, I thought, you know, if we were in a different universe, where in the last 10 years I had been able to get a camera and I had like a green screen over here, I would try and do that. And we'd shoot a video with
that would
this,
be amazing.
Against this green, like when I got the green screen, maybe one day we'll do this.
Well, I mean, honestly, like it won't take much to make a green screen.
Yeah. I mean, the fabric store is right around the corner.
Yeah.
My camera is not going to be able to do it well. I need the skills to do the green screen replacement, but that's the direction things are headed. And, you know, but we'll have to come up with some other type of project without
okay.
this full.
Totally. I am so down for whatever. Like, I'm really like,
yeah, well,
I'm like, can I be creative? Okay, I'm there.
Yeah, so,
you're okay with my opinion on things? Fan-fucking-tastic. Cool.
Yeah, we've had a very far-reaching discussion here.
Yes.
I think we're at the point where we can let this distill for a moment, and we'll, you know, probably make some kind of music and,
okay.
and record it over the next hour or so. And then
perfect.
We'll post it up, and it'll be tangential to all this stuff. All right, anything else you want to say for the podcast?
Here, because we talked about this earlier, and it made me think of it. You talked about taking the shit and, like, planting a seed, and there's specifically a mantra, which is Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, which is from the darkest mire, the most beautiful lotus grows. Mm. And in response to that, I had written something which was, life gives you what you put into it, and true beauty can arise from dirt, death, and shit. Mm. So that's what I leave you with.
Well said.
Fertilize.